From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
War and Peace in the Graveyard of Empires. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Last week, President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize as he concluded a series of strategy sessions on the 8-year-old war in Afghanistan. His commanding general wants to add 40,000 troops to the 68,000 already there to fight the Taliban and establish effective civilian government. It could take billions of American dollars and thousands of lives to control corruption, establish a justice system, and prop up the economy. What are the alternatives? What are America's goals? We'll look at the options today. On Reporter's Notebook, football, concussions, and memory-related disease. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Does Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan threaten U.S. security? What about the Taliban? What will it take to establish a credible civilian government? Should the U.S. send more troops or begin conducting a graceful withdrawal? We'll look at some of the questions facing the latest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. On Reporter's Notebook, the National Football League is assessing a new study that shows former players 19 more times likely than other men to suffer from Alzheimer's and other diseases. First, the news update. After months of collaboration with the Obama White House, the insurance industry is now warning that a crucial version of health care reform might push premiums too high. It's the Senate Finance Committee bill championed by Max Baucus and scheduled for what could be a make-or-break vote tomorrow. Jeffrey Young covers health care for The Hill. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
What does this report say?
Well, essentially what they say is that the way the bill is currently structured, it was changed during committee, that not enough people will be legally required to buy insurance. And the result will be that those who do buy it will end up paying more because people who are healthy and don't necessarily need it won't bother to get it. There's a lot more to the report than that, but I think that's probably the most, in my mind anyway, the most important piece of it. And that those effects on higher premiums would filter through in various ways to everybody. And there are a lot of things they didn't factor in to that report. For example, the fact that the bill also provides subsidies to people up to 300% of poverty to buy insurance, so that would make it cheaper for them. But it's in some ways more important that they're bringing this report out now than what it says.
You would certainly assume the insurance industry would want more rather than fewer people required to buy insurance.
That's right. And essentially the arrangement they had loosely all along was that they would be willing to submit to strict new regulations on what they could do in the marketplace. For instance, they would have to accept everyone, regardless of whatever their pre-existing conditions or medical histories were, that they would agree to limits on how much they could vary premiums based on how old someone was or how sick they were or things of that nature. That only works for them in the marketplace if everybody has to jump in.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the situation instead is that everyone is permitted to jump in, but that large numbers of people, maybe 15 million or so of the currently uninsured, that it don't have to, or that it's cheaper for them to pay a fine or a penalty for not buying insurance than it is to buy it, then they could theoretically get stuck with a bunch of sick people who cost them a lot of money, but they can't charge them higher rates as a result.
Is the release of this study, do you think, designed to stop the committee from voting favorably for the Baucus bill, or is this a last chance for the insurance committee to get in a word before the boat leaves the shore?
I think what you said there, the second one, is a pretty pretty accurate description of where things are right now. If I can be forgiven for the cliche, you might say that we're sort of at crunch time here. Once the Finance Committee votes tomorrow, and incidentally, I personally would be very surprised if it didn't pass, only because Democrats who vote against that bill in committee, if they stop it there, it might be permanently dead. The whole project might be finished. So some of them may have to hold their noses, but I'd be very, very surprised if that doesn't get passed tomorrow. But once it does, all the committees are finished. And then the final look, the final shape of this health care legislation will be in the hands of the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate and of people in the White House. And once it gets down to that very small group of people, powerful people, it becomes much, much harder for anyone on the outside, including the insurance industry, to influence what ends up in the bill. So then they have to take their fight public and hope that they can sway public opinion in such a way that that will, in turn, influence these leaders. And I think that's where we are right now.
And the Obama White House at the moment is saying this is a lousy study, it doesn't really show what it's supposed to, and it ought to be disregarded.
Yeah, I mean, the risk for the insurance industry, and clearly they're seeing a lot they don't like in this bill, and they obviously don't think they have a choice to do otherwise, but the risk that they set up for themselves is they've now picked a fight with the White House and with the Finance Committee and with the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate. I don't know who might win that, but it puts them in a position, potentially, if the, at the political level, of the public trying to decide, who do I trust more on health care? President Obama or the health insurance industry? It's a tough call what side I think most people would choose there, but that's a calculated risk that the industry is taking here.
When we say the industry, is the entire industry united as far as this report is concerned, or is it pretty big? Is it divided up?
I'm not aware of any individual companies that have stepped forward and said anything different in general terms about what their goals are and what their misgivings are when it comes to health care reform. The particular group that put this report out is called America's Health Insurance Plans, and they are the trade association that represents all of the large insurance companies. There's another trade association that only represents Blue Cross Blue Shield companies. They didn't sign off on this report, and they don't appear to have been part of its commissioning. But throughout this process, they have communicated very similar ideas about what they think the health insurance marketplace ought to look like under reform and what things they don't want to see. So it's fair to say that, you know, there may be some folks out there in the industry of a different standpoint, but no companies have jumped out and you know, run counter to their lobbying group.
All right. Coming down to the wire, just as rough a battle as ever. Jeffrey Young with The Hill, thanks very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
In a moment, War and Peace in the Graveyard of Empires on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. President Obama is on the verge of a momentous decision. Should he agree to General Stanley McChrystal's request for some 40,000 more troops in Afghanistan? After a week of strategy sessions, today's New York Times says the president is impatient. Peter Baker is now assigned to the White House. 8 years ago, he was Moscow correspondent sent to Afghanistan just as the war was beginning. Peter Baker, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
You said yesterday in a lengthy piece in the Los Angeles Times, reflecting on what you had seen in those past 8 years, that first of all, so many years later, you were surprised that the country would still be trying to figure out how to win or whether it could win. And then you also said that President Obama seems to be grasping at ideas that have been regurgitated year after year without limited success.
Yeah, well, I think that's it feels like that. I mean, if after 8 years we haven't tried this idea or that idea, it's hard to imagine there's a whole lot new under the sun. Some people will say is that we haven't really tried a fully resourced mission of the sort that General McChrystal is asking for, because we've always kept our footprint light. We haven't had as many troops there as we did in Iraq, for instance. But, you know, this concept of do we do counterinsurgency and protect the population? Do we do counterterrorism just focused on the bad guys? All these debates are sort of part of a cycle that we've been through these last year, 8 years without a lot of clear resolution.
What is it that the president now is so impatient about?
Well, I think he's, you know, this is not what he wants to spend his presidency doing. You know, he has a lot of ideas, he has a lot of ambitions, and slogging through a war that may, in fact, turn out to be, for him, a quagmire like other presidents have experienced is just simply not part of his game plan. So I think he's impatient with the fact that that none of these choices are easy, or none of these choices are any kind of guarantee of success. And he's buffeted on all sides by pressures that are difficult from the left in his own party, growing impatience with the war that he is saying he shares, from the right, an impatience that he's taking so long to make up his mind, and this should be, in their view, a no-brainer, support your commander.
And your paper is reporting today that he's impatient because of the failure to get something going with regard to creating a functioning government, a legal system, training the police force, which is riddled with incompetence. So I gather that it's not just the military situation, but the civilian one as well that he's worried about.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. You know, the civilian surge that we've talked about in the past. You know, again, this is the kind of thing we've talked about a long time. A lot of people have said for, you know, ages now, we simply have to train enough Afghan soldiers and Afghan police that they can take over the fight. And so when you hear people on the Hill or in the administration say, the real key here is just is this training of Afghan forces, and just we just need to be patient, it'll take time. Well, what have we been doing for 8 years? It's a very frustrating situation for, I think, not only the president but anybody else who is in charge of trying to come up with a solution.
Peter Baker, a White House correspondent for the New York Times. I think I misspoke earlier. And also a former Moscow correspondent assigned to Afghanistan as the war was beginning. You said spent how many months there?
Well, I spent about 8 months in Afghanistan and Pakistan right after 9/11. And it was a fascinating experience and a really formulative time in our national experience there.
Peter Baker, again, a White House correspondent for the New York Times. Thomas Ricks is senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. His latest book is The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq, 2006 to 2008. That's a sequel to his book, Fiasco. He also blogs on national security for Foreign Policy magazine. And Thomas Ricks, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you.
What are the goals in Afghanistan? Are we trying to defeat just al-Qaeda? Are we trying to defeat the Taliban and set up a new nation or a functioning nation there? How would you describe our goals?
At various times, it's been all of those. The fundamental goal, though, has been to somehow prevent a repeat of 9/11. At its very core, the 9/11 attacks emanated from Kandahar, Afghanistan. That's where people came together, discussed this, and prepared for it before going on to Germany and the United States, in fact. But it's about how do we stop another 9/11? And in many ways, the problem is as much Pakistan as Afghanistan. As a friend of mine says, though, it's hard to win a war in one country when the enemy starts fighting it in the next country over.
Well, how many al-Qaeda people are left in Afghanistan? It's often said that there are so few that if we were just to concentrate on them, perhaps that's all we'd need to do.
Well, the problem is they can move back and forth quite easily. So the question has to be how many are left in those two countries? How many will go there from other countries if we're not around? And that's why, well, the Taliban present no fundamental existential threat to the United States. If the Taliban run Afghanistan, the question is then, does al-Qaeda come back and have the free operating space they had before 9/11 there?
How do we prevent that?
Well, that's the debate. What is the best way to prevent that from happening? Apparently, according to Peter Baker's always excellent reporting, and Peter Baker really is the go-to guy in all this, Vice President Biden has been an advocate for going for a reduced presence and just going after al-Qaeda. Other people say, you can't do that. All you do is create more enemies and help the Taliban gain power. That if all you do is focus on al-Qaeda, you end up losing Afghanistan, losing it to the Taliban, and creating exactly what you don't want, a safe haven for al-Qaeda.
So what is the guarantee, if there is any, of sending 40,000, 60,000, however many more troops it is that General McChrystal has asked?
There's absolutely no guarantee, and I think that's one thing that kind of freaks out President Obama, which is, wait a second, I can go ahead and ruin my presidency and get nothing out of it. It's one thing to say, you know, okay, I'll go down in flames, but at least it'll take care of this problem. What he's being offered is you can go down in flames and still have the problem, which starts to feel a bit like Vietnam. He's being told, look, a counterinsurgency approach, that is, protecting the population, dividing them from the Taliban and al-Qaeda, training up Afghan forces, and to an extent, helping rebuild the economy, is going to be a long, expensive process. I've heard that McChrystal is thinking of terms of 3 to 5 years for this whole operation. And it might not work. And that's the essence of what he's considering, and I think considering quite deeply, but in a rather agonizing way for the U.S. military.
Do you have an opinion?
Yeah, I think you probably should do the counterinsurgency approach. It's certainly got no guarantees of working, but I'm pretty certain from what we've seen over the last 7 years that a counterterror approach, this raiding against al-Qaeda, hasn't worked. In my opinion, the Biden option, as people refer to it, going just after al-Qaeda, is what we tried, and it's been not only not particularly productive, it's been profoundly counterproductive. There are two main reasons that we're losing the war in Afghanistan right now. One is because of U.S. bumbling, U.S. distraction, going on to an unnecessary war in Iraq. The other is the Afghan government, which is one of our two basic enemies there. The Afghan government's corruption and abuses of the population. The best way to counter abuses of the population is to have American eyes on, to have troops, American troops, be at a checkpoint next to Afghan troops. It won't eliminate abuse and corruption, but it'll reduce it.
Thomas Ricks, again, the Center for New American Security, a prolific writer of Fiasco, and now The Gamble about Iraq, former reporter for The Washington Post. Christine Fair is assistant professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. Christine Fair, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What's your take? Are you a person favoring the Biden approach, favoring the counterinsurgency approach, or is there another way?
Well, I have to say I'm more inclined towards the Biden approach, not because I think it was the optimal approach to take from the initiation of this conflict, but I'm somewhat of a realist. I think we made a number of cascading mistakes. They're going to be very difficult to reconcile. When we first went in, the Afghans were asking, when are the rest of you going to show up? And we failed to replace this light footprint that we went in with the right footprint, and you know, obviously Mr. Ricks has written about this extensively, and namely that had to do with our distraction by going into Iraq. And the net consequence the last 8 years is that we've been able to put enough troops on the ground to create more insecurity, but not security. And if you look at the public opinion polls in Afghanistan, which are certainly a difficult exercise, and certainly those polls should be looked at with some dubiety, but the trend is very clear that Afghans are becoming less tolerant of our presence. And when there is violence against civilians, be it by the Taliban or by international forces operating with Afghans, they hold us accountable. The argument being, if you weren't here, there'd be no insurgency and these civilian deaths wouldn't happen. So at some point, I've sort of resigned myself to the fact that it may be very difficult, if not impossible, to recover the mistakes that the international community has made. And quite frankly, we've also cultivated in Karzai a sense of impunity that he is indispensable. And if you look at the sort of ill governance that he's provided, including the appointment of pederasts and narcotic traffickers to important posts, yet the money kept coming, you certainly couldn't fault him for having this sense. So I think about this series of mistakes, both in allowing Karzai to continue behaving in a way which is unhelpful to him and to our goals, and yet the money kept coming, as well as our mistakes militarily and otherwise, I'm a realist. And I think instead we have to ask ourselves the question, if the counterinsurgency cannot be won, how do we still protect our interests? And so I think this question of, if the Taliban come back, will al-Qaeda come back is misplaced, because the Taliban never left. And the Taliban have consolidated their positions in the south. They're making new inroads in the north. And the Taliban participated directly and indirectly in this election. So I think a realist appraisal suggests that we need to ask ourselves, what's our plan B when plan A has clearly failed?
Christine Fair at the Georgetown University Center for Peace and Security Studies. Back to Tom Ricks with the Center for a New American Security. Each of you is saying that the other's alternative is going to make things worse rather than better.
And it might very well be true that we're both right. I mean, this is a messy situation that we have not handled well. The question is there anything to be done? My view is, yeah, you should at least try a genuine counterinsurgency approach, which we haven't done until now, partly because I think the approach that Professor Fair outlined is kind of what we've been doing. So why continue with something that's not working?
Isn't the cost, though, of something that has no guarantee, as you've indicated, and might, in fact, be likely to fail, going to be pretty great, both in terms of treasure and American lives? And will there be pressure to continue on, even, Tom Ricks, if it's failing?
This is one of the hardest aspects. People will think it's failing early on. I think back to Joe Biden and the surge in Iraq. In the spring of 07, about 4 months into it, he declared it an utter failure and said, let's leave Iraq. Now, I don't think Joe Biden's been right about much in the last 15 years. In fact, he's a leading counterindicator. If you do go with increased troops in Afghanistan, carrying out a counterinsurgency campaign that puts them out among the people, that puts them at checkpoints, that gives them off big bases, yes, U.S. casualties will go up. And it'll be a very rough several months for the U.S. military and for the White House. And I think that's one thing they're considering is this president has expended a lot of capital in different directions, Guantanamo, healthcare, the economy, and now Afghanistan, and hasn't had a lot to show for it, and this will take him deep into the red. And I think one of the things they're considering is simply, can we politically survive this over the next 12 months? Now, coming out of that 12 months, it might look better, but it'll be a bumpy 12 months.
Christine Fair, could the president politically survive at this point if he said, I'm not going to send troops? Wouldn't he be attacked for not supporting the troops that are already there?
Well, again, you know, I think this is a fake binary. There are a couple of questions with respect to the troops. There is the question of how many there are, scaling up or scaling down. There's also the question of what it is that they're doing once they're there. So one of, you know, I don't at all disagree with what Mr. Ricks is saying, but let me put on the table one of the concerns that I have, which is why I'm dubious that an actual coin approach is going to work. Let's take, for example, the police training program. The focus on the police came so late, inexcusably late, as it did in Iraq and also as it is in Pakistan. And the current program is called the Focus District Development Program. It was meant to deal with police corruption. So you take all of the police out of a district, you send them off for 10 weeks of training. Now, one could even question whether or not that made any sense. And then you put them right back in the district where you have the same corrupt district governor, the same corrupt provincial government, the same corrupt chief of police, and all the other notables that are deeply involved in illicit activities. So even if we had a fully resourced Focus District Development Program, and I might add that the mentor billets right now are filled at a rate of 1 in 3, so 2 out of 3 are just not available. Even if we had the best program, the corruption of the Karzai government renders that program ineffective.
We'll be right back with To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking to today about the multitude of bad options facing President Obama with regard to Afghanistan. Christine Fair, assistant professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, is just telling us that if we go with a full-on coin program, that's counterinsurgency, that corruption will be, as I believe Thomas Ricks also called it, major enemy, the government itself being our second enemy after the Taliban. Excuse me for being a little confused there, but I hope I made the point or summarized the point correctly. Professor Fair, what, though, about the use of the drones and the anger that they stir up amongst Afghans, who you've already said are very unhappy with the American presence, when inevitably civilians are killed?
Well, a couple of issues about the drones and about al-Qaeda in particular. There is this tendency to conflate al-Qaeda with the Taliban, and that al-Qaeda is not running rampant all over Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda tends to be located in one province in the north, and that's Kunar. So I think the al-Qaeda issue is much more manageable than is than is typically thought. And there is this really interesting irony. You know, there are more al-Qaeda ensconced in Pakistan than there are actually in Afghanistan. And because we need Pakistan so severely to move logistics into Afghanistan to support this war, we're really constrained in our ability to put pressure on Pakistan, only obviously on al-Qaeda, but a whole range of militant groups that attack India and also affect, they're very much involved in international terrorism like Jaish-e-Mohammed. So it's really interesting and yet ironic to me that as we consider putting more troops into Afghanistan, our requirement for Pakistan becomes ever more intense, and that actually constrains our ability to put pressure on a government where I would argue we have far more security interests at stake. There's been a lot of discussion about a northern fuel route. I just came back from Kunduz. Kunduz is becoming a heavy kinetic area where the Taliban have really made a stronghold. And the Germans, unfortunately, have control of Kunduz, and I think they're running a peacekeeping mission. So the northern route is really impracticable in terms of how difficult it is to move the kinds and amounts of supplies that we need into theater, leaving aside the lines of communication, the safety thereof, once you enter Afghan territory. So the bottom line is, it's very strange to me that we're having this discussion when there's more al-Qaeda, there is a greater terrorist as well as a nuclear proliferation threat in Pakistan, and our need for Pakistan to support an expanding war effort constrains our ability to act there.
Okay. You don't propose large numbers of American troops going into Pakistan, do you?
No, I don't, actually. This goes back to the drone discussion. You know, drones in Pakistan, there have been some pretty escalated numbers about the numbers of civilians killed. But folks who actually live in Fata have a very different take. They actually know that that's not the case. The precisions of the drones have really improved. Now, one can ask what the value is of using drones vis-a-vis some of the targets that have been eliminated. But a colleague of mine in Peshawar actually sent me a poem about, it's called An Ode to the Drone, celebrating and thanking the drone that killed Baitullah Masood. So for people that are in the federally administered tribal areas, they have a different take on drones, and there's been some limited survey work done in that area that actually suggests people in Fata, the federally administered tribal areas, support the use of drones. And interestingly enough, the drones haven't displaced 4 million people. The Pakistani low-intensity operations and SWAT, among other places, did. And if you read the Pakistani press, Pakistanis are no longer saying drones are bad. In fact, the Pakistanis are asking for their own drones. So the discourse has really changed from drones are bad to let us have our own drones or at least pull the trigger on your drones.
Justine Fair, again, assistant professor at Georgetown University. We'll come back to her, back to Thomas Ricks at the Center for a New American Security. First, I want to introduce Selig Harrison, who's director of the Asia Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington. Selig Harrison, always good to have you on our program.
Good to be on.
You have raised other questions about the counterinsurgency approach having to do with the difficulty of organizing and or better organizing and improving the Afghan military because of various ethnic conflicts. Can you explain those?
Yes. You know, we just by accident, when the United States went into Afghanistan after 9/11, we joined up with the only group that had boots on the ground, which was a Tajik ethnic minority militia known as the Northern Alliance. And we found ourselves going along with the installation of a group of Tajik generals in charge of all of the security agencies, the army, the secret police of the new government in Kabul. And although we had a Pashtun, the major ethnic group in Afghanistan, in the person of Mr. Karzai, as the nominal president of the government that was established, he was really regarded by the Pashtuns themselves. You know, a huge 42% of the Afghan population are Pashtuns. He was regarded as a sort of an Uncle Tom Pashtun who had gone along with letting these Tajiks take over all the agencies that count in Kabul. What does that mean? It means that 70% of the battalion commanders in the Afghan army are Tajiks. So they can't function very well in the Pashtun areas against the Taliban, and they can't recruit Pashtuns to the Afghan army. So the whole idea of building up an Afghan armed force against the Taliban is really paralyzed by this ethnic situation in which we find ourselves, which the Taliban, based in the Pashtuns, with Pashtun leaders, can point to the government in Kabul and the Americans as allies of their historical enemies, the Tajiks. And of course, the whole, I mean, I agree with a great deal of what Christine has said, but I'd emphasize more the fact that the very fact that we are a foreign occupation force is a major problem. And the more troops you put in, the greater the opposition you stir up. That's been shown by history, but it's also, in this case, we got an American, the image of the United States is particularly distasteful to the Pashtuns because of our policies in the Middle East and the Persian Gulf. So it's a very unpopular occupation. And I think, as Howard Hart, the former CIA station chief in Pakistan, put it, the very presence of our forces in the Pashtun areas is the problem. The more troops we put in, the greater the opposition, unquote. So we're really in a, and we've got the Pakistanis supporting the Taliban, so we really have got to be thinking in terms of how we can gracefully extricate ourselves from this unwinnable counterinsurgency idea without turning Kabul over to the Taliban. And I think the only way we can proceed in this situation is to try to bring in other countries that also have a stake in keeping out the Taliban. You know, this is a situation in which you have India, you have Iran, you have Russia, you have Tajikistan, you have China, all neighbors or near neighbors of Afghanistan, all have a stake in a situation in which Afghanistan becomes stable and which you don't have Taliban rule. The only problem child in this situation are the Pakistanis who want to keep the pot, who want to make sure that they have their Taliban boys in a powerful position in Afghanistan. And I think that what's called for now, I think, is a sort of a diplomatic scenario. You have to bring in these other countries in a series of conferences. Henry Kissinger has talked about such a conference in Newsweek this week, and Hillary Clinton mentioned it back in March at the NATO foreign ministers meeting, and she even said that Iran would be a welcome participant. But then nothing came of this, and unfortunately both her proposal and Kissinger's assume that we can just go on carrying on our counterinsurgency role and then try to bring in these other countries on the side. Well, they're not going to play that way. I think that in order to get a diplomatic scenario that broadens the responsibility for containing the Taliban, we're going to have to have a timetable for withdrawal, which I would set at around 3 or 4 years, during which time we would keep American forces and NATO forces guarding the major cities and the highways. And we would try to, having laid down a timetable, I think we'd be able to get some local Taliban peace initiatives of the kind that have been mentioned by General McChrystal and in the original Obama administration policy review. So I think that we really have to get realistic about this and recognize that a counterinsurgency strategy is just a complete dead end, given the ethnic context in which we find ourselves, married to a Tajik-dominated government trying to combat a Pashtun insurgency.
Selig Harrison, director of the Asia Program for the Center for International Policy in Washington. Back to Tom Ricks at the Center for a New American Security. What do you say to that, particularly the issue of the ethnic makeup of the military?
I agree with both Harrison's and Fair's diagnoses, but really find myself sharply disagreeing with their prescriptions. I've actually seen counterinsurgency work in Iraq. I think work tactically. I don't think it worked strategically. In fact, the surge failed, I think, in Iraq. But you can really change the behavior of local powers, the police and the government, if you have American troops out there. I mean, the argument that Selig Harrison makes, American troops are an irritant, is the exact same reason that the U.S. military chain of command made in arguing against a surge in Iraq. General Abizaid, the Central Command commander, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, basically everybody in the military except a couple of generals were against the surge in Iraq, and they made all the same arguments. And basically they were wrong on Iraq, at least tactically. on how to change the behavior of the Iraqi government. These are not theological problems. They are very practical. If corruption is a problem, and I'm told, for example, there are 5 checkpoints right now between the Pakistani border and Kandahar. At each of those checkpoints, there's a shakedown, and people, truck drivers, have to pay to drive through their rice and their canned goods and so on. If you just had 1 checkpoint at the border and 1 outside Kandahar, which you need, and if you had American troops at both, you would substantially reduce the corruption and the tax on the Afghan stomach. Afghan kids go hungry because of those checkpoints. That's a very concrete example of how going to a counterinsurgency strategy, which we have not been doing, would change the game on the ground at the local level in Afghanistan.
But
we've never tried that.
In terms of what Selig Harrison just said, though, what about the problem of having the Pashtuns, the majority in Afghanistan, refusing to be part of a military led by the Tajiks?
I think people understand that, and that's one reason you really have to work on the Afghan government in the same way that we tried to work, not entirely successfully, on the Iraqi government. You have to view the Karzai government as an adversary in this process. And that's, for example, one reason that David Petraeus, as the commander in Iraq, went to the Sunni insurgency, not only talked to it, he put it on the American payroll. They didn't surrender. It's a ceasefire. They were allowed to keep their weapons and their units, and we gave them $30 million a month. Now, the Baghdad government, dominated by Shiites, hated that. You can do the same sort of thing, and if counterinsurgency is going to work in Afghanistan, you have to do the same sort of thing. Cut deals with Taliban leaders, with tribal leaders, to bring Pashtuns into this and to make them able to defend themselves. Yeah, you want Pashtun police and Pashtun neighborhoods. You do not want Tajik troops knocking around the Helmand Valley. That will feel like a worse occupation than American occupation.
Selig Harrison?
It's not just whether they're in the Helmand Valley. It's the fact that the whole security setup in Kabul itself is run by Tajiks, the secret police, who stick it to the Pashtuns who are challenging Tajik control. This is a question of the control of the state apparatus in Afghanistan. And if we were to get religion and say, well, we made a mistake back in 2001 in letting the Tajiks take over, and now, sorry, boys, you guys got to get out, and we're going to put in a Pashtun a chief of staff of the army, and all these battalion commanders are going to be replaced. Well, what's going to happen then is total instability, a Tajik reaction that would be quite strong, and I don't think the phrase civil war is too strong.
Thomas Ricks, a quick response. Excuse me for interrupting you, but I'm concerned about time. What do you say to that, civil war?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I think it's possible.
And worth the risk?
Yeah. Right now, you're in the worst possible situation. You're there enough to make a mess, but not enough to solve it. Yeah. So if either you really start taking some strategic risk, or you get out.
Let me go back to Professor Fair at Georgetown University before we run out of time. What about this suggestion of going soon to the international approach, particularly with regard to India? Wouldn't the Pakistanis be particularly upset if we brought India into this? They're already worried about the relationship between India and the Afghanistan.
Well, a number of structural concerns. Going back to Selig Harrison's point, in some sense, we did let the Indians in. I don't think what's appreciated here in Washington is that the Northern Alliance, which is the Tajiks that Selig Harrison is talking about, among others, was actually trained and nurtured by India during the Taliban period. So when we basically hand over the keys to Kabul, Islamabad read that as handing the keys to the Indians. Now, there are a number of structural features that make the situation in Afghanistan, I think, substantively different from Iraq, and I think the Iraq comparison is a false one. First of all, al-Qaeda was foreign in Iraq. Iraqis rising up against al-Qaeda made sense. The Taliban are not foreign. They are absolutely Afghan. And I totally agree with Mr. Rick's point that there needs to be some sort of flipping of the Taliban, incorporation of the Taliban into some, I don't want to say reconciliation, but some reintegration process. That's already happening. In Afghanistan, unlike Iraq, you have an absolute paucity of human capital. Iraq had functioning line ministries. 2, there is absolutely no prospect for Afghanistan to pay for itself. So if we continue building the Afghan national security forces that we are slated to build, under no assumptions of economic growth or domestic revenue extraction can Afghanistan ever pay for itself. And that's simply a fact.
So what kind of money are we talking about?
We're talking huge. Right now, Afghanistan's external, basically 95% of Afghanistan's budget is paid for by the international community, and that includes everything that the state does. They couldn't even pay for this election. So no one's talking about how we're going to fund these enormous institutions in perpetuity. Afghanistan is now more a rentier state, one that lives off of the generosity of external sources than it ever was. And I might add, it was always a rentier state, first under the British and then under the Russians. And the other issue, and I absolutely agree that the counterinsurgency in principle is the best approach to take, but I'm a realist. We don't have the civilian capacity to have some civilian sitting there mentoring the Ministry of Justice official, setting up a functioning Ministry of Justice facility at the district where the Taliban are most effective. And without this so-called civilian surge, I don't know how we do this coin thing. Going back to the Afghan police, yes, it's true if you've got some Dine Corps mentor sitting there at a border checkpost keeping an eye on the guy, it's more difficult for him to engage in the corrupt practices. But they're not going to be there forever. And what we've seen with the police training, as soon as the mentors are gone, they're left in the same corrupt political structure, and recidivism is what's evidenced. And absolutely, finally, it's Pakistan. Even if you had the best Afghan governance in the world, which you don't and you won't, Pakistan really sees Afghanistan as a zero-sum game. It's either a stable state aligned to Pakistan, or it wants a chaotic state where the Indians have difficulty operating. And right now, it's the worst of all worlds for Pakistan. The Indians are all over the place, and their Taliban proxies are of an unfuture certain, or an uncertain future. And if you're Pakistan reading the writing on the wall, its nemesis India has excellent relations with Iran. It has a tighter relationship with Kabul than Islamabad ever did. It's expanding its presence in Central Asia. It has a base in Tajikistan. It's negotiating some base access to Uzbekistan, and it's improving ever more its relations with China. So what you really have is an existentially insecure state in Pakistan. And going back to the point that I made earlier, Pakistan is the fulcrum. Unless we can put pressure on Pakistan to stop supporting the Taliban, to stop supporting a raft of militant groups operating throughout the region from Pakistan, our national security interests are okay. Far more compromised.
All right. We're out of time. Tom Ricks, very quickly, if you can, Professor Fair says the comparison to Iraq just doesn't work. It's a false one.
It's not Iraq, but there were lessons that were learned in Iraq, attitudes that we learned in Iraq, especially humility, that can help. But I think she's totally right that Pakistan is the fulcrum. The reason we really care fundamentally about Afghanistan at this point is Pakistan. Pakistan is the biggest problem in the world, and I think it's drifting towards falling apart.
So international approach then, such as Selig Harrison proposes?
Yeah, knock yourself out, but you've got to do something for the next year. It's going to take a year before any international diplomacy had any effect at all in Afghanistan. So what do you do for the next 12 months?
Thanks to all. Tom Ricks at the New American Center for the New American Security, his most recent book, The Gamble. Christine Fair, assistant professor at Georgetown University. Selig Harrison, director of the Asia program at the Center for International Policy. And our earlier guest, Peter Baker, White House correspondent now for The New York Times. The National Football League has long denied that retired players are subject to Alzheimer's or other memory-related diseases, but a study commissioned by the NFL itself now reports otherwise. What will that mean not just for the pros, but for high school and college players who often suffer concussions? More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The NFL commissioned its study from the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan. One neurosurgeon calls it a game changer. That's according to the New York Times in an article by Alan Schwartz. Alan Schwartz, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
In what way might this be a game changer?
Well, the significance of this study lies in the fact that it was commissioned by the NFL originally. There have been many studies and ones with more significant findings, frankly, that have been done by outside folks. However, this is the first one that the NFL has done that has found any link between playing football and later life cognitive problems. That was the issue of the most significance. because this was only a telephone survey, and that has a lot of problems with it. However, the numbers that came out of that survey were far and beyond what people can just ascribe to the faultiness of surveys.
19 times the normal rate for men ages 30 through 49.
Yeah, I mean, it was 5 times the normal rate for men 50 and older, and 30 to 49, 19 times that of the national population for Alzheimer's disease, similar dementias or memory-related diseases. Now, I should caution everybody that don't take the numbers too literally, okay? Because again, it's a telephone survey. However, you don't get 19 times randomly, and you don't get 5 times randomly when you have a sample of over 1,000. And so, what this showed once again is that there are a lot of former NFL players who are having some terrible cognitive problems. By no means is a majority of those men experiencing any cognitive decline, any that can be ascribed to football. It's relatively rare, but nonetheless, it exists. And the league, to this point, and through the revealing of their study a couple of weeks ago, they've denied that any evidence exists suggesting there's any link whatsoever, and they still claim that.
What about other health issues?
Excuse me?
What about other health issues and playing football? Are there any? Have there any studies been done on things other than head and memory issues?
A ton of studies have been done on that area. I mean, they've found that retired players have a terrible time with arthritis, with chronic pain, with joint problems, needing hip replacements, shoulders, backs, knees, hips, things like that are a huge problem. That being said, I think that everyone knew that was an occupational risk.
Sure.
Now, other things like heart disease and some other issues, they actually have less of, in part because they're healthier men, in general. And also, they have access to better medical care in general. So, I think that the one that people have found the most alarming, however, is the cognitive/dementia area, in large part because the league denies that there is any evidence of it when most everybody else seems to find it so plausible.
How is this liable to affect colleges and high schools?
It won't affect it directly by any means. I think what it does is it helps reassert how important it is when a player receives a concussion or thinks he might have. Do not suck it up and play. Do not try to impress your coach how tough you are. It's a really important injury. Come out of the game, get treated, and you can't mess around with it. And just every time a story like this comes out, and there is going to be more, there are going to be hearings before the House Judiciary Committee on head safety in football, is every time something like that takes place, articles get written, interviews like this get done, parents hear it, coaches hear it, players sometimes hear it, and if we can get them to understand the severity of the injury, we can't avoid all concussions in football. That's crazy. It is going to happen. When it happens, if players come out of the game and get treated, a lot of these issues will be minimized.
How often does it happen? How often do players, particularly at the college and high school levels, play hurt because they think they're being macho and that's the culture?
Oh, it happens every Friday. I'll guarantee you that 10 to 50 teenagers in four days from now, 10 to 50 teenagers will play with a head injury that, if they sustain another one and sort of lightning strikes in that way, they will enter coma and possibly die.
Wow.
It is that prevalent. Now, by no means does this happen all the time. Of course not. But about 10 kids a year do have what is called second impact syndrome. It's confined only to teenagers. It's because the brain is not quite yet developed and is susceptible to damage a little differently from adults. And I've talked to the parents of 50 different high school kids who were either killed or seriously injured because of playing with or experiencing a football head injury.
Are they working on better helmets?
Well, they, of course. There are a couple of companies, Schutt and Riddell, that claim to, you know, always trying to put out a better helmet with the foam that they now have. There's a new company up in Boston called Zenith with an X that has designed a helmet with these unique shock absorbers that release air, and is a whole new design that appears to be promising. A former Harvard quarterback who experienced concussions himself, Vin Ferrara, is behind that company. I think there's a lot of promise there.
All right. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this, no doubt. In the meantime, Alan Schwartz with the New York Times, many thanks.
My pleasure.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Christian Bordahl and Gary Scott, technical director Wesley Roberts, managing producer Cameron Radziner. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.